I'm here today to do a few things. If I had an opportunity to ask you all what you would like to get, you know, to get out of hearing somebody who knows a lot about eating disorders. I'm a psychologist who works specialising with eating disorders, and I work with young people and young adults who have eating disorders as a clinician. And I also work, that's working sort of with eating disorders, then I work on the system, working with training and service development and things like that so that the disorders get treated better within the system. So I had a chance to ask you all individually kind of what you'd like to get out of hearing someone with my kind of background talk. I'd like to be able to do that, but obviously I can't. But in the meantime, I'm just wondering how many people here know someone well or someone in their family, whatever, who's had an eating disorder or who has an eating disorder? Looks like a lot of people. Who doesn't? Who doesn't know anyone who's been in that situation? Because they're not many people, yeah. What about in your professional life? Would you just give me a show of hands if you've ever come across someone in your professional life who's been in that situation? So that's just about everyone. Okay, thank you. So that gives me confidence to go on and know it's important. So the things that I've decided to cover are really what's at stake for our young people? How do we recognise when someone's going in the direction of an eating disorder, and what can we do, basically? So I'm hoping that when you leave here this morning for morning tea, you'll feel as if you understand more about eating disorders and how they evolve, and you'll understand what's important about early intervention in relation to this issue, and that you feel equipped to know what should I do or what can I do in that situation. Okay, so we'll begin with understanding a little bit more about eating disorders themselves. So let's look at a few myths. I think that we in mental health, and we generally as a culture, used to think that eating disorders were not kind of really serious mental illnesses. They were more a bit of a lifestyle choice that got stuck, and that they were mainly about appearance concerns. And it's true that in an eating disorder, people do become very preoccupied with their body weight and shape. But what I think we've understood in the mental health field over the last 20 years is that eating disorders are as serious mental illnesses and have as serious consequences as our most other serious disorders that we hold as the most difficult ones, so psychotic disorders and major mood disorders. So the consequences of these disorders are extremely serious. So they've kind of gone into a bit of an attitudinal shift, if you like. So we'll talk a little bit more about how they evolve as well. So eating disorders are serious and potentially life-threatening mental illnesses characterised by severe disturbances in eating and exercise behaviours because of distortions in thoughts and emotions, especially those relating to body image or feelings of self-worth. So eating disorders aren't only about food and eating, although they are about that. They're also not only about vanity or about willpower. Eating disorders are also a public health concern and they're on the rise. So myth number two, and this is a tricky one to think about, dieting is a normal part of life. What do you reckon? Is it? Is it a normal part of life? Scary thing to put up your hand for maybe, because obviously I'm going to say maybe no. But it's in and among, isn't it? It's everywhere. It's in staff rooms. People are always talking about diets. Just have a look at this though. This very authoritative and very nice researcher from America, weight control practices among young people reliably predict greater weight gain, regardless of baseline weight, than of adolescents who do not engage in such practices. This is a very countercultural message. There's a lot of social messaging out there around weight loss, and there's an enormous industry, obviously, that supports that that position. However, the research increasingly in adolescents and also in adults doesn't support dieting as an effective way of managing weight, so that's really tricky. So just thinking about what your own relationship with that is and what kind of messages you want to support. So every time I go on a diet, I lose my mind. Unfortunately, it doesn't weigh very much. Truly, it's funny, but it truly does express something about what goes on for a lot of people with dieting. So myth number three, eating disorders are a cry for attention or a person going through a phase, and it can feel like that, can't it? Especially for a young person. What's going on? Why are they having these behaviours? The fact is that most people who have an eating disorder don't tell you. So it's much more of a secrecy and shame-oriented situation than a cry for attention. And the research shows that most people don't get better from eating disorder without intervention and treatment. So neither of those things are true. And there's also a little bit of a blame in there, isn't there, that maybe the person is kind of creating the situation. We don't have any evidence at all to show that we can blame the person with the eating disorder. So the causes of eating disorder are still kind of a little bit up in the air, but we understand that there is actually a very strong genetic component, which I certainly didn't understand 10 years ago. So there is as strong a genetic component in the causation of eating disorders as there is in schizophrenia or other major mental illnesses. So it runs in families. It has to do with your genetics and your biology. Then it has to do with social triggering factors, which I don't think I need to go into. I think you would be aware yourselves of what kind of triggering factors around weight and shape are there for our young people. And then for a vulnerable person then, that adds up to a very, very serious mental illness. That's the sort of picture now, rather than that is it's this sort of light thing that kids might kind of do. I think we've already talked about that. So another myth is that families, particularly parents, and actually in the past probably particularly mothers, good old blame the mother, are to blame for eating disorders. People have tried actually to link particular styles of families to eating disorders, and there's been no success in doing that. There is no one family style or situation which can be said to cause or be in relationship to the causation of an eating disorder. Families are not to blame. So individuals are not to blame and families are not to blame for eating disorders. So eating disorders only affect white middle-class females, particularly adolescent girls. I mean, I don't know about you, but I still, despite all my years in this area and all my own patients, still hold a little bit of a stereotype of a skinny, clever, white, high, you know, middle-class girl. And this is not really helpful because this is not what's happening in our culture anymore. So people in all age groups, genders and socioeconomic and cultural backgrounds can be affected by eating disorders and are. So it's kind of shifting that stereotype in your mind about who you're thinking about. A person with an eating disorder, and this is another really tricky one, can be underweight, which is normally the stereotype, within a healthy weight range, or they can be overweight. So again, it just works against that stereotype. It's broader than that. When we think about eating disorder, we think this, don't we? Anorexia? Is that what you kind of think? Yeah. But maybe we should be thinking more like this, that all of these people in this picture have a serious life-threatening eating disorder, even the one on the right. So we're seeing a lot more eating disorders in men, in particular in boys. As the rise of sort of gym culture and more pressures on men around appearance, the more young boys are being triggered into this situation. And unfortunately, a lot of boys don't get picked up because you know how boys do that incredible growing thing where they look like a beanpole anyway. Sometimes boys might get very active and actually be getting really sick, but we don't notice. We just think, oh, look at that, you know, this kid is taking hold of their health and growing in that way. So boys and young men. And some of the young men who I've seen, and my clinical experience I think is like that of my colleagues, get very sick very quickly. So when you have a young man who's sort of going into excessive exercise practices and things like that, young men can get very sick very sick very quickly. So I'm not going to go through these. I've actually put quite a lot of slides in my talk for you to see later and for them to be there as information for you. So I'm not going to go through everything, but I'm hoping my slides actually do form a bit of an information pack for you when you go through them later. But just quickly, what are eating disorders behaviourally? Okay, so the first thing that I do if I'm going to have an eating disorder probably is that I starve myself. Normally that's out of a shape weight preoccupation, but it can also happen, say, if I go to India on a school trip and I can't eat and I start to sort of not eat and I just get caught in this pattern. Or it could be even for a dental procedure, but usually it has a strong shape weight sort of motivation at the beginning. So I starve myself. And if I continue to starve myself, all sorts of things happen in my brain, all sorts of things happen in my body and in my life, and it becomes a trap. And for someone with that biological predisposition, it becomes an extremely serious mental illness, and that's what we want to get in the way of. We want to get in the way of that process because it's so serious and there's so much at stake for those people. So I don't know if you know anybody who has long-term anorexia nervosa. It's a very, very debilitated and very difficult way of life. Normally extremely isolated, very difficult. So that's one behaviour and one pathway, if you like, with an eating disorder. Another pathway is that you begin the same way with restriction, but then it becomes too much because your organism wants to live, because your organism doesn't want you to starve it to death. You'll become completely preoccupied with everything around you that has to do with foods, the smells, the sights, everything there is, and you will binge. So you'll eat a lot of food. Can you imagine that? That the organism's just like, it's like trying to drown yourself, right? Your organism's going to fight. You want to starve yourself. Your organism's going to go, no, I need to eat. And I eat a lot of food, right? Then if my whole my whole self-worth is based on my weight and shape. Can you imagine that? That so 80% of your self-worth in this situation is based on shape and weight. That's what the mental illness is doing to me. So most of us here would have a sort of self-worth that's based on numbers of things, being a friend, being a parent, perhaps being a student, being a worker, a whole lot of things. For someone with an eating disorder, they'd become trapped into a situation where their self-worth is actually based on, mainly based on this issue. So if I've eaten a whole lot of food and my self-worth is based on being thin, what am I going to feel? Guilt, massive guilt. What else? What's that? Yep. I'm going to be panicky, shamed and panicky and horrified. And then I try and do something to get rid of the food. And there's only three ways to get rid of your food. One is to vomit it, and one is to use laxatives, and one is to do excessive exercise. So then we get into this pattern of bulimia, which means eating a lot, restricting your food, eating a lot, and then using these compensatory patterns, which is what they're called, to get rid of the food. That's why it makes sense. Then the other main eating disorder is called binge eating disorder. That's when I restrict my food usually and then eat a lot of food, but I don't do the compensatory weight things. So they're the three kinds of eating disorders. Okay, so how many people, you know, what are we talking about here? People have started to say we've got to stop thinking of eating disorders as rare. Current Australian data show that about 9% of the population are affected at a given time with a diagnosable eating disorder. Anorexia and bulimia affect between 2 and 4% of the population. And up to 20% of women may have undiagnosed eating disorders. Let you read that. Prevalence, so we're looking at anorexia, 1 to 2%. So if our class size is about 25 kids. So if we've got four classes, we're going to have 1 to 2 kids in that class who's likely to have an eating disorder, have anorexia nervosa. With bulimia, it's about 2 to 4%. Binge eating, more than 5, but probably up to 5% of the population. And there's another category which is sort of across categories, and that's another 5%. So is it all men, and, you know, how do we go, men and women? Anorexia, it's 90% female, but that leaves 10% of boys. Bulimia nervosa, it's 85% women. Binge eating disorder is different, and this is something that I bet you don't know. Binge eating disorder, they're looking at about 50-50 male and female. So there are a lot of men out there suffering from a really strong binge eating, which is a very strongly disturbed eating pattern, as well as women. And why does it matter? What's at stake? You know, I kind of think of eating disorders a bit like some of the other problems that confront our young people. I sort of think it's kind of a plane, and we send our young people out into life, and there are certain sort of holes or traps or sinkholes you can fall into, and this is one of them. So what's at stake when a person starts dieting? And we don't know if they're one of those people who has that particular kind of biological and psychological vulnerability. What's at stake? Recovery. Half of young people in that situation will recover within 5 years with treatment. A third have a relapsing course, which means that mental illness is going to dog them throughout their years. And 20% have a long-term illness. And that long-term illness, as I said, is not a life fate that you want to see any young person that you care about be having. So what's the mortality? So the mortality on anorexia nervosa is twice that of women with any other mental health condition. And it approaches 20% of people with anorexia long-term. So if you think about that in relation to other illnesses, it's a very serious risk for a young person setting out in that way. The suicide rate in anorexia is actually 1.5 that in major depression. And normally it's major depression in which we're most sort of concerned with our clients and our young people in terms of suicide, but actually it's 1.5 times in anorexia. So it's a very serious set of circumstances. There are significant comorbid illnesses that often go, so anxiety, mood disorders, personality disorders, substance abuse, all of these things may fit into a pattern for a young person with an eating disorder as well. So I'm not going to go in detail through those impacts of eating disorders, but clearly there are going to be massive changes in the person's life. The person really struggles to communicate with other people. It's very isolating. They lose their sense of self because they have a constant obsession around this particular kind of area. Depression and anxiety just go with the territory completely. The other thing about eating disorders that makes them really difficult is that there's a whole series of physical consequences that go along with them as well. So normally with mental illnesses, we're more concerned with what's going on in the person's mind and their heart and their soul and their functioning and their relationships. We're certainly concerned with all of those things with eating disorders, but we're also really concerned with what's going on in their body, because we've got major problems with malnutrition and growth delay. We've got acute medical stability problems, which means danger of sudden death, and that sudden death would be by cardiac issues, and that's in particular that's most dangerous when the person loses weight rapidly or and is of a very low weight or and is purging a lot, and this is just to do with physiological factors. So eating disorders have this added danger, physical danger factor, plus the long-term issues of bone growth. There's stunting, there's fertility problems, there's a whole series of things that happen in that way. I think the rest of the things, obviously education, work, and all of those things are impacted as well. Medical risks I've just mentioned. So what is it that leads to this, and where in relation to being people of influence with young people, what is it that we can do? So we're moving now into kind of risk factors for eating disorders. So are our young people that worried about body image? What do you reckon the answer to that is? Yes, unfortunately, they really are. So our prevalence data for major concerns around body image is very high. I'll just look at the second one here. You're familiar with the Mission Australia studies, the annual studies they do of about 25,000 Australian young people, so it's a very big sample. Body image has been rated in the top three concerns every year since Mission Australia was begun in 2006, and it's been the number one concern on three of those years. So, and in 2010, it was the number one concern of both boys and girls. So that means concerns about what your body is, your weight and your shape, and how that relates to sort of social ideals, was rated higher as a concern over mental health, over academic concerns, over family relationships, over anything. Don't you think that's amazing? That our young people are in a situation where that is of such enormous concern to them. And the reason that's so much of concern to us who work in eating disorders is that body image problems trigger extreme eating and disordered eating practices, which then trigger the eating disorder. So you probably don't get an eating disorder without some form of dieting. So we also know that we've got high and increasing rates of disordered eating behaviours, which we would expect from what I just said, yeah? So, for example, 10% of adolescent girls in the year 2000 showed disordered eating behaviour. In 2000, 6 years later, 18% showed disordered eating behaviour. And another factor is that 40% of school counsellors feel not competent in helping students with an eating disorder, which is completely understandable. So who's at risk? How can we find out? How can we look and see which of our young people are kind of in danger of falling into this trap, and what do we do? So risk factors of disordered eating, and there are lots of them, but these are the ones we can change and look out for, but in particular the ones we can change. So typically people who get in this situation are perfectionistic in relation to their orientation with life. They have low self-esteem, they have high body dissatisfaction, and there's a strong internalisation of the thin ideal. So that means a strong buying into of the fact that I need to be thin and have the right shape in order to be a good person or in order to be successful or whatever it is that the young person's associated with there. And then dieting, the fact of changing your food patterns. So specific high-risk groups, as you might imagine, are all these areas where weight and appearance and performance are linked. So gym, ballet, all of these kinds of areas. Maybe you're looking at your body a lot, comparing it to that of other people. You can imagine how that would raise a young person's risk. So specific, students under stress are also specific risk groups. Year 7's a really tricky year, as you would all know, in relation to transition. Therefore, the possibility of starting these practices in order to feel like, well, I've got this under control, this is going to be right, I'm going to be able to succeed with this, that's going to be great. So year 7 and some later years. Students are experiencing bullying and peer difficulties as well. So how do we see, you know, who's having these problems? You know, I think the message I really haven't succeeded in giving you yet, which I really need to give you, is that one of the biggest things we know about treatment of eating disorders is that the earlier that we bring someone to treatment, the better chance they have of getting out of it. And that is, this is very real clinically. When somebody's just started, there's a little bit of a honeymoon where it might be all feeling really good, and that's kind of hard, and then things will start to go difficult. And then as the years go on, it sort of becomes more entrenched in the person's personality and their way of dealing with life, and it gets harder and harder to help that person out of the eating disorder. So one of the strongest research findings and clinical findings that we have is that we need to be intervening early, and that's why I'm so glad to be here today. So few young people will volunteer to anyone that they have an eating problem, unfortunately. So if you're in a situation of talking to someone who you think might be having problems with depression and anxiety, do ask questions about eating. It's something we often forget. You know, you're asking about someone's welfare, you ask about their sleep, ask about, you know, how the basic physical parameters of their life are going. Yeah, eating, sleeping, whatever, and you might be surprised what you discover. There's a really terrific document called Mental Health First Aid Eating Disorder Guidelines, and I've put that, that'll be in your PowerPoint. That gives you this really great list of warning signs and of ideas about how to intervene, how to talk to the person, all of these sorts of things. I really recommend that you get that document and also make it available in your, whatever your youth situation is. Warning signs of an eating disorder. I'm not going to go through these in detail because it would take too long and you can read. I'll just put them up quickly so you can put your eyes over them. And they're going to be in your PowerPoint. What I do want to read to you are some of the things, a set of parents who've had kids with eating disorders put together this list recently. This is worldwide, because they wanted to be in a situation that they could help prevent other people being in the situation. These things they say, this is how they divide it, things kids say when they're getting in the situation. None of these, by the way, are isolated signs. You have to take them together. I just want to eat healthier. I want to be a vegetarian. My stomach hurts. I'm not hungry. I already ate. I think I'm allergic to something, which I was never allergic to until last week. I don't eat this. This is not organic or GMO. A whole series of things, different ways of cutting down from food. Things that young people might be doing. Disappearing after meals, which is a sign of purging. Checking out nutrition labels and increased exercise, pushing the food around the plate, not eating it, cutting food into tiny pieces, stop making plans with friends and becoming quite isolated, taking forever for it to get to the table at meals and being very moody around mealtimes. Can you get the feeling of this? So it's a matter of watching and seeing what that young person is doing and how it fits together. And things that we can observe from the outside, so things like being overdressed in summer and underdressed in winter, bloodshot eyes after meals, odd seating positions in meals because you've put the food away into your clothes and things like that, obviously losing weight. If the dog sits too close, this is parents, I'm not saying if the dog sits too close to your kid all the time, you might be a bit suspicious the dog's getting more than just closeness at mealtimes, might be getting food. So menstruation also is an important sign, as in cessation of menstruation. So one mother I talked to described it. She said, look, with my son, you know, at first I just thought he was exercising and I thought, that's great. He was in grade six and he's really sort of taking hold of his life and that's terrific. And then he started saying, oh, I only need really half a sandwich at school now. And she thought, well, that's pretty weird. This kid is growing. He only needs half a sandwich at lunchtime. So she said to him, oh, how about I come and run with you for your exercise? And she said, I ran with him and I immediately knew something was wrong because he wasn't in any way enjoying the running or being in the world. He was on a mission. He was completely obsessed and he had to run whether he had a broken ankle or whether it was, you know, whatever. And she knew, because she knew him well, she could feel that that was, you know, tipped her over. And that boy did have a very serious eating disorder and, you know, which took a long time to clear up. So it's like this confluence of signals. Okay, weight and appearance isn't a good indicator. 80% of cases won't look anorexic. Listen, if parents say there's something wrong, if family and if kids at school say something's wrong, you know, it's quite likely there is. I don't know how much you get at schools kind of reports of kids being, oh, I think there's a problem with this person. If they say that about their eating, there quite probably is, because it's the people who eat with a person who knows what's going on with that person's eating. So a young person won't instantly be willing to talk to you about this. And as I said, we're looking for clusters of behaviour. So say I suspect a young person's having an eating problem. What do I say? And these are the non-recommended approaches. So putting your head in the sand is a non-recommended approach for the reason that it's just so important to bring this out in the open and get something to happen about it. And butting heads with the person and going, you have to do this immediately, is not actually a recommended approach either. If you are an adult that suspects that a young child is, as a young person, is developing or experiencing an eating disorder, this is really important. You should first actually approach the parents, because getting early intervention for this young person is crucial, as I've said. Earliest possible intervention and assessment is really, really important. And it's actually going to be the parents who are going to be needing to take that person to where they need to go and organise that referral. I realise not every family will be able to do that, but the thing is that we must bring the family in right from the beginning, and we have concerns. And, you know, typically the family will also have concerns if you have concerns as well. So we must do that before approaching the young person directly. So our job will be to encourage the young person to seek further support and help. We don't have to convince them they have a disorder. We don't have to go into a whole diagnostic sort of thing. We just need to move them on into the next stage. And in this instance, it's kind of better to have a go and be wrong, you know, to make a mistake, than it is to be safe and let it go on. So if you approach a young person in this situation, you would be kind of saying, look, I'm concerned about this, rather than things like, you seem to be having an eating disorder, do you know? Try not to jump too early. It's kind of, I'm concerned about these kinds of things. And then quite general things. You've been preoccupied or distant, I wonder what's happening for you. I'm sure you all have ways already of kind of entering into a conversation with a young person that doesn't make that person defensive. So it's just using that same vocabulary that you already know and leading it into things around eating. I'm not going to go on with that. So how will the person react? How will the young person react? It's quite likely that the young person will completely deny that there's a problem. They might get angry. They might just rationalise it really well. Eating disorders have good ways of sort of beating you off, if you like. They might dismiss you. They might even be a bit contemptuous of your concerns. That would be quite typical. Or sometimes they'll be relieved. Sometimes they say, oh, that's really good, someone's noticed. There's a problem, yeah. Okay, so making referral is absolutely crucial. And the thing is, it's a jungle out there, because it is kind of hard to find the right place to send people. The bottom lines around referral are that a person with an eating disorder, developing an eating disorder, needs an urgent assessment by a qualified mental health clinician and a GP. And this is because, remember how I said there's like the psychological side of it and there's also the medical side? That quite often people can actually be really, really sick, even too dangerously sick, without anybody having noticed yet that there's a problem with the psychological side. And when we actually give people, move them towards treatment is always having both of those at once. So a psychologist can't see an eating disorder client without there being a doctor. And a doctor or a GP shouldn't be seeing an eating disorder client without there also being a mental health professional involved. That's just a bottom line and a given. So that's what we're heading towards. GPs don't always pick up emerging eating disorders. In fact, they quite often don't. So this is a tricky one. So if we have concerns around the area, we actually have to find a GP and talk to the parents and get into a situation where we know that that's going to be taken seriously as a concern. Because sometimes eating disorder GPs won't have the message I've already given you, which is we have to act on this really early. So they might be thinking, oh, well, I don't know. He does look, you know, a lot of boys grow that high and, you know, this isn't necessarily a problem. Don't listen to the, you know. So we need to make sure that's taken seriously. And as I said, assessment with a psychologist or another mental health care worker who specialises or just experiences and knowing about eating disorders is really needed. So parents are the most important people, really. We want to get parents empowered in this process. Just for your interest, evidence-based treatment for eating disorders at the moment, under the age of 18, is a family-based approach for the first go, okay? It's about the family coming together to actually refeed their young person. Whereas for adults, it's kind of getting that young person and the adult themselves to kind of work against the eating disorder themselves. So it's a, they're different treatment strategies. And part of the reason I'm really emphasising the family in talking to you about what needs to happen at the beginning is because the family are going to be involved, hopefully, in early treatment for a young person with an eating disorder. Okay, so I've given you some sort of information around where to check out with referral. So what can I do? What can you do to help with body image? When we sort of and eating disorders in schools and in youth situations, we don't the research tells us actually we don't talk about eating disorders directly. We don't talk about vomiting, we don't talk about laxatives, we don't talk about these sorts of things because there's a possibility that young people will try those things. Okay, so we don't do that. Yeah, you can read about the presenters there. There are evidence-based programs for schools, and Media Smart is one of them. So Media, it's interesting, there's several really good evidence-based programs that have been developed in Australia, and Media Smart's one of them. That's helping young people to be able to see through kind of the media images and things that they're getting to reduce that internalisation of the thin ideal I was talking about. And this works particularly well with younger children who haven't yet sort of cemented their relationship with media. So that's one. I've given you some research data on how to locate that one. This is another series. This is from Melbourne researchers. And again, this work's been picked up by Dove internationally. So there are resources also available through Dove, which are great. So these are three school-based, it's a school-based program, then an early intervention for young adults, and then for community people. Again, this will all be in your PowerPoint. And this tells you about the Dove resources. So Dove are actually putting together, I think they've got a 5-session version, and then there's going to be a 1-session version for young people about body image and preventing eating disorders, which I understand are freely available. And it's got a teacher's manual and sort of, you know, sheets and all of that kind of thing as well. So that's really good resources. And what can you do in your school? So what isn't helpful? It isn't helpful to complain about your own body, you know? It isn't helpful to be going, oh God, I look so fat, you know? I had that, you know, eating so much and, you know, blah, blah, blah. It isn't helpful to use weight as the only indicator of health. In fact, it's not very useful to use weight as the main indicator of health. It's actually not useful to make comments about appearance as much as you can. And this is a tough gig because most of us do it a lot. And I mean, myself, I love clothes and I love, you know, what things look like. And so it's really tempting when I see, you know, I see people and I'm like, oh, that looks really good. But I try and hold myself back with my clients and other people because we overemphasize appearance in our relationships with each other already. Our culture does that. So as people of influence with young people, one thing that we can do is to really emphasize other qualities and to be commenting on and affirming qualities other than appearance. So appearance has an impact, but let's just try and keep that to ourselves and try and affirm what else is real. You know, people's energy, their initiative, their wisdom, their confidence, their energy, all of the things that young people have to be focusing on those and trying to hold back on the appearance things. Once we had a family camp with a few families and we did it, you know, we were like, right, we're having the no body talk, we called it, family camp. It was only for a week or something, and it had a massive effect on the kids. They found it really annoying and really interesting and all of that kind of thing. Being at the beach and going to, you know, beach holiday and everything, but having no discussion around your body. That's really interesting. So it's not useful to do that. So another thing that isn't useful is allowing appearance-based teasing to occur. It's a documented and researched risk factor for eating disorders to be teased by your family or by your peers about your body. So we must actually jump on that. We must stop that if you, in your family or in the school ground or whenever you see it. It's not okay. These experiences stay with young people and they can trigger these behaviours. And again, if you're one of those people who has the vulnerability, bang, you're into a serious illness. Labelling foods as bad or no or fatty or all that sort of thing, it's better to label foods as everyday foods and sometimes foods, not moral. Food's not moral, you know. Food is just sort of food you eat sometimes and food you eat less often. Try and stay away from a moralising sort of bad, good relationship with food. Just don't promote weight and shape as being crucially important. Don't weigh or measure students. I don't know if anyone's in a situation in a school or a youth situation where that happens. That's really triggering and very difficult. Okay, what's helpful? As I said, complementing non-appearance attributes, emphasising other things, encouraging scepticism about all that media stuff, challenging the idea that only thin or muscular is beautiful. There's lots of other ways of being beautiful that you know, variations in body shape is completely normal. Act as a positive role model as much as you can, despite your own insecurities or your own buying into the thin ideal. Act as if you're perfectly fine about it all, for our young people's sake. Eat regular meals and snacks and let people, young people, see that you're eating regular meals and snacks. And if you have a, you know, sometimes I eat a packet of Tim Tams at night, not sure if that's a binge or not, but I would try and just say, yeah, I ate the packet of Tim Tams, you know. Be aware of how health is taught in your school. It's better if the orientation of the program is towards health rather than thinness, yeah? So we want health rather than that. Check anti-obesity messaging is not being delivered too strongly or too... There's a whole worldwide, if you're interested, there's a whole movement called Health at Every Size, which is a political movement, and a sort of practical movement, which is about defining health in relation to internal parameters rather than weight and shape being the predominant message. So if you're particularly interested, just look up Hayes, H-A-E-S, and there's a lot of information about that. We must be nearly to the end. So if I have kids who are obese and restricting, what do I say with one? You know, this is a problem, right? They're the basic health messages that I've been saying, is that variation in body shape, completely normal, to do with culture and family and a whole lot of different things. That what we want to do in life is we want to eat normally, which means eating pretty much six times a day or at least three times a day. So we don't want to leave it more than 4 hours between when we eat. It's just normal for our bodies to need food. We eat regularly is an absolute key message. And that if I kind of exercise a bit, do some movement, and I eat regularly, this is my body. Yeah? That's kind of the message. Here's some other ideas. So it's health promotion, not obesity prevention. These are guidelines, international guidelines around this. Intervention should focus on modifiable behaviours like activity, eating regularly, decreasing fizzy drinks and screen time, because they are actually identifiable as risk factors for obesity. But also at the same time, promoting body satisfaction and body acceptance. Body shaming doesn't work for anyone. It just becomes a paralysing factor. Can you imagine that? So people who are over their most comfortable weight probably know they are, and they don't need anyone else to tell them that they are. What they need is to have a sense that they're okay as they are, and there are things that all of us can do to live in a healthy way. Does that make sense? Even kids, they don't really need us to tell them that they're over their most comfortable weight. Okay. So overall, eating disorders happen to a lot of different kinds of people. Early treatment is crucial to recovery. Body image concerns are major risk factors in disordered eating and dieting, and therefore eating disorders. You can use evidence-based programs, like the ones I've shown you, to help young people, and that you can use evidence-informed principles to make a difference through your own behaviour and through the cultures that we create in our schools and our situations for young people. And I think that was my last key message, but just let me check. I guess the main thing, I just want to say, it's a trap for young people. We can get in early, we can really help them, and there are stuff we can do. So I do wish you the very best with all of that.